Thank you very much. Right, great slideshow. I'm going to step back a bit and or step over and ask some of the environmental questions about what we've been hearing. And in fact, Ina's talk was a very good ending. Africa, that's what you get. And I'm in Kenya, so I've got to acknowledge a very good Kenyan writer, Binyavanga Wainaina. And Binyavanga has written a wonderful article on stereotypical preconceptions of Africa, that as soon as you mention Africa, you get poverty and you get dyness. So Africa is not only this image of development demands and development needs. Africa is also, in the words of our Minister of Education, a place that produces research and knowledge, and research and knowledge that is a value to the rest of the world. And we tend, I think, to underestimate that. This was at a conference, a UNESCO conference at the end of last year on higher education. And there was a session on Africa where our Minister of Education, Blaise Nzimande, gave the keynote address on behalf of the Ministers of African Education. And it was reported all over the world, but not much in South Africa, because he said, we're working in a neocolonial paradigm still. He says, we're still in a situation where Africans are cast as the consumers of information and the rest of the world as the producers of education. But what's important to me here is what I've highlighted in red. He said, this is not only negative for the African continent, but it deprives global higher education of access to the indigenous knowledge of Africa, and it deprives Africans of the opportunity to develop their indigenous knowledge system and strengthen their relationship to Western and Eastern knowledge systems. And please, this is South African speak. With our rather peculiar history, indigenous in our speak means we're talking about black African research and writing, the voice of Africa, in other words. It's quite useful, incidentally, having a higher education minister who's leader of the Communist Party. It leads to some fairly challenging views of what we're about. And at that same conference, Nahas Angula, the Prime Minister of Namibia, said what African leaders always tend to say. How could the application of knowledge end poverty and hunger? How could higher education empower women? How can knowledge be considered in the African context to address child mortality and improve maternal health? In other words, if the metric that's being looked for here in African research is what the science fiction writer Neal Stephenson would call the body uncount. He did it rather cynically in a novel, but what it means is how many people did not die because of the research you did. So those are the demands. People constantly asking us, how do you use research? If we're investing in research, if we're spending money on a poor continent, how do we grow, how do we deal with millennium goals? How do we address development? But if you look at the picture of science research in the world, if you look at this projection, that's actually where we're at in terms of our preconceptions of how higher education works. I don't know if you've seen these before. These are a series of maps by an organization called World Mapper that does geographical projections according to the data they're studying. And this map is of the publication of scientific articles. Just look at it. I don't have to give you statistics. I don't have to give you anything. But don't forget there are two things going on here. One is that it looks as if we're very skinny in this world. And if we're doing anything, we're giving our valuable research up north where they don't need it. But the other thing is the measure. As soon as somebody says higher education, how do we measure it? Journal articles. And we don't question this. And to me, suddenly the penny dropped when I've been researching policy since about 2006. And I was looking at a policy document from the South African government in 1994. And that's exactly when South Africa was emerging into democracy. It's when the rest of the continent was grappling with the aftermath of the World Bank and IMF depredation of higher education, with the bizarre idea that primary education was how countries grew their economies. And so Africa was trying to get back on track with its research, and South Africa was just beginning. At that stage, the policy document said this: we want research to contribute to development. But we're very disappointed because we can see that research isn't contributing to development. How do we know that research isn't contributing to development? It's not producing enough outputs. It's not producing enough patents or journal articles in the ISI index journals. And nobody questions that conjuncture between publishing journal articles, publishing in ISI, and producing development impact. So if we look at that profile of Africa, the question we ask is the problem what's being produced or what's being measured and how it's being measured? That's the world of ISI indexes and journal articles. Now, I hasten to say right away, I am absolutely not saying that this is not important and we mustn't do it. I must get that clear up front. You could hear this morning from our discussion that however critical we are, there's absolutely no way that we can get away from participating in this world. But what we have to acknowledge is this is a world of competition. It's a competitive environment based on individual effort, and he who can jump highest, the Olympic athlete, is the one that wins. And as is true in the Olympic Games, it's the Olympic athletes from the north who do better, more food, more money, more training, more support. It's a skewed world. We play the game according to other people's rules. And I think we have to be aware of this when we play the game. You could hear it in this morning's rhetoric. If you want your medical articles to be published in the leading scholarly journals, in the indexes, the most high-flying journals, you have to adapt your scholarship to what is expected in those journals. You have to get the international perspective on what you're doing, not the local. Now, interrogate those words. We in the developing world are 80% of the world, but we're considered local. The other 20% of the world is considered international. And I love putting, I haven't done them today, but I have two slides, one of Nelson Mandela, one of George Bush. And I want to know which one is international and which one is local. So one of the challenges here is, yes, let's participate in this world. Let's do it well, because actually we've got very good researchers. But let's start thinking about what our world is. And Michelle, sorry, could you just pass me that newspaper supplement? My reading on the aeroplane, I picked up the weekly newspaper, and what I got from my own university was this, a supplement in the Mail and Guardian, which is a very good weekly newspaper. And it's UCT Research. Now, this is the leading research university on the continent. It's the only one in the top 200 of the Times Higher Education rankings. It's actually, according to an article last week, got into the top 50 in the world in biosciences and medicine, natural sciences and medicine. But our vice chancellor is saying research is central to knowledge production and South Africa's development. And in this, the university is profiling what it calls its Afropolitan research. It's research that connects to Africa and profiles Africa as a global force. So there we are. We have to compete in this competitive environment. And so we measure impact factors in this exclusionary system as a way of seeing how we perform on that map. But we pay less attention, as Mary said this morning, to the publications that emerge from development-focused research. There again, there are hierarchies. This goes back to the 1950s and is actually linked to the guys who were developing the atomic bomb, the idea that applied research is less valuable. I love it. It was Vannevar Bush who actually promulgated the idea that there's a hierarchy, basic research is better and applied research is inferior. And if the atomic bomb wasn't applied research, I don't think anything was. Now, this institution I'm in, which is this high-flying institution, pushes very hard to get journal articles pushed out and get international rankings and international collaborations and so on. When we examined it, and Michelle was working with me then too, we did a case study of UCT and what it does. And we discovered that it actually is also superb at developmental research. It just doesn't promote people so much for it. So here you've got this tick again that came up this morning, that people do developmental research. You say that that's what the government wants. The government's going to cut our funds if we don't do it. But we don't think of the publication output that's needed. There are 62 research groupings at UCT, all quality controlled and peer reviewed. And we discovered that a very high number of them had for decades been putting publications online with the expectation that people access them freely. Some of them articulated the need, an anti-apartheid need, A unit that dealt, for example, with poverty research, said unless they put their research online in the apartheid years, they were defeating their own purposes. Other units, you know, like the high-level biological and medical research that we do, many of them like to distribute stuff because they believe that there's not a contradiction between high-level basic research and saving lives. This is the African Center for Cities, a very high-powered multidisciplinary research center that tries every possible perspective on how to deal with the problems in African cities. And if you just have a rapid scan of that web page, first page, you'll see they're producing multimedia films, research articles, research briefings, applied research, data, conference papers. In other words, they're very consciously disseminating research. But this is on the UCT website, probably 5-6 clicks down. They're quite good at it. Some of them 10 clicks down. This is happening, but it's not being surfaced. It's not being exploited strategically. And it's not that our policymakers don't see the problem. I mean, here's our higher education minister again, saying we shouldn't be doing this neoliberal thing of producing impact factors in commercial journals, because obviously as a good communist he doesn't like that world, but we should be contributing to the community. So we've got policymakers and universities acknowledging the importance of development-focused research, but somehow we're not actually making mileage of that. We're not really profiling those research outputs. We're not taking charge of them, and we're not promoting people for them. And I think the reason is we're stuck in a free rider syndrome. Don't know if you know what free riders are. I couldn't resist that. That's a Bangladeshi version of free riding. In South Africa, we tended to do with only a few guys hanging on the outside of the train. But the idea is you don't have to do it because somebody else is going to do it. And it comes from this idea of riding a train without paying. So the somebody else who's going to do it is clearly big international publishers who make big profits out of it. And to respond to the point made this morning, was it by Mary, about her outrage at Nairobi University Press wanting money to publish her book. The other thing that comes out of the free rider syndrome is this absurd idea that scholarly publishing makes money in Africa. Scholarly journals make big money internationally, and I hope Biomed Central is making money now. It's taken a while, hasn't it, to build up. You know, I wish you luck. But university press publishing, can I say this loudly and very clearly, please? University press publishing cannot make money in Africa. You cannot sell enough books to pay for the development of the book and the printing. It doesn't work. Harvard University Press humanities editor Lindsay Anderson said, asking a university press to pay for the university is like asking the church mice to pay for the church. And that's Harvard. We're Africa. You want a story about why it's like that in Africa? First, we had a whole lot of people who were very good at drawing lines on rulers, deciding on our geographical boundaries. So there's a certain absurdity in that. But just an anecdote, our librarian from the African Studies Library in UCT, probably one of the best resource libraries on the continent, he said he every now and then jumps in a plane and he comes across to East Africa. He lived in Tanzania for a long time. And he drives around meeting people, talking, finding out what he can lay his hands on, getting stuff, putting it in his boot, packing up it in boxes and sending it to South Africa. And that's how he builds his collection. We call it grey literature. I would challenge the idea of grey literature in a digital age. The definition of grey literature is it's grey because it's unfindable. Everything is findable in the digital era. Why are we mistreating so much of the knowledge we produce as grey literature? Because what Colin's finding is valuable grey literature all over Africa, literature that is below the watermark of the iceberg, all kinds of things happening that are not recorded internationally. UNESCO, for example, only records imports and exports of books to tell us how many books are published in the world. And, of course, we don't import and export much, another story. A bookseller from Cape Town in the years that the Zimbabwe Book Fair was flourishing used to take a trailer, pack it full of books, drive the 3 days to the book fair in Zimbabwe from Cape Town, declare her books at customs at the border, and they counted them because you have to pay duty, heavy duty, on any books that go into the country, so she had to bring them out again. So in she went, she sold them all, she packed her trailer full of all the books she bought, and she drove out again, making sure she had the same number of books. Barter works across African borders for physical products. The normal sales don't. There are tariff barriers, huge transport costs. For those of you who come from London, it costs more to fly from here to Kenya than it costs to fly from here, from Cape Town to London. So there are those kinds of absurdities about Africa. And it's crazy in that environment for us to stick to a value system that is actually still largely built on the business model of printed publications. And I don't have to say anything because Bob did it brilliantly this morning, the way that system works. But the trouble with our focus on impact factors and high jumping is that we get tunnel vision. We don't see what we're doing. I've mentioned that already. We ignore all except a tiny little slice of our ecosystem, of what we actually produce. Formal publishing doesn't work very well for us, but we believe in those UNESCO statistics that we're actually not producing much. We don't look at what we really are producing. So the question I'd ask in this room, and I'd love us all to go away and think about it and produce it, we've done projects where we've surfaced what's been produced, and it was stunning. We found people, for example, we talked about popularization of science, translation of science, transformation of science. There are highly professional service provider companies with strong digital and publishing skills who do that for a living. They can translate the most complex science to rural communities. There is just, I think, a great deal of work being done in our continent that, as our minister said, is being ignored. And I love that image of probably what happens to journals going across African borders. Couldn't resist that. To me, open access is a no-brainer answer. And it comes from my conversion on the road to Damascus, I think it was 1994 in the United States, when as a university press director, I went to the Association of American University Press Conference. And there was a two-day conference on electronic publishing in 1994. There were guys doing this saying, we're Adobe Acrobat, we've just invented this thing. And there are other guys saying, you can surf the web, we've got Mosaic and Gopher. So it was all very new. So there you've got Africa beginning to emerge from a period of perdition in research and the net starting at the same time. So to my mind, this was leaping the barriers. I already knew it wasn't profit-making, so I didn't see that selling stuff was a problem. Free stuff seemed to be the right thing. The ethos is, I think, what we're after. It's collegiality, sharing, efficiencies, networked. And it's very much what Matt spoke about this morning in the ethos of Biomed. It overcomes distribution barriers. And here we have my first African example, the HSRC Press, with a map there showing where its publications. It's a leading example internationally of open access social science publishing. Downloaded in every country in the world except Greenland. Nobody's done research yet on why Greenland. Very high impact, high influence, read as a first stop by policymakers, journalists, parliamentarians, academics. It's local stuff, social science research out of Africa. Unfortunately, the HSRC, in its wisdom, has decided this has been such a successful unit, produced so many very good books, and sold so many copies, they sold much more when they gave them away free, that it's now actually effectively dismantling it. It's asking to make a profit. Profit was not what it was about. It was profiling the organization and getting money for contract research. But we need to overcome distribution barriers, but we also need to work across the whole ecosystem that constitutes scholarly communication, a very complex area. And Michelle will talk a bit more about this in the moment in our project. It's not simply a matter of publishing journals. It's a matter of analyzing what is going on in the scholarly environment in a digital age in a developing country that we need to analyze. So commercial publishing and journals offer us obviously very big advantages. Here I think we have our cake and eat it. We can publish in high-impact journals. We can get that international profile. But we can also access our own articles. And I think, as Biomed has made very clear this morning, we can also take those, adapt them, translate them. And that is very important. We can put data sets under them. We can link multimedia to them. I am skeptical about the argument of Stephen Harnad in the UK, who says all you have to do is repositories. I think repositories are absolutely invaluable, and putting the journal articles that are published in the big international journals online is essential. But I think we have to take care of marketing ourselves and selling ourselves. Nobody's running to Africa to get our knowledge. We're going to have to sell it. So we have to publish our own journals and produce our own books and produce our own research reports and produce them properly and market and promote them properly. So we have this environment where we can get promotion, access, prestige, reach from international commercial open access publishers like Biomed, and that must be an essential part of our strategy. The freedom to reuse is vitally important. There are also open access international university presses like Bloomsbury. And interestingly, Frances Pinter at Bloomsbury is brokering an idea that she talked about recently of setting up national consortia for selling scholarly monographs digitally to libraries. We'll see if that works. But they work on the principle, all the text is open access, but you sell the physical book to libraries that want it. There are cooperative publishing platforms like BioLine International, which is committed to providing open access to research journals from the developing world. And this, again, gives space for developing world journals to go online and to be profiled. And as BioLine says, to bridge the knowledge divide and reduce the north-to-south knowledge gap. In South Africa, I don't know if you know about this, the government is investing through the Academy of Science in a process of peer review of journals. As I said, African universities produce research that addresses needs. This is the PLAS, which is the Afrikaans word for farm. It's a leading agricultural research organization. These kinds of units produce research reports, briefing papers, policy papers, data sets, popularizations, community manuals. All of this is going on, but beneath the radar. And they release on open access, sometimes informally. We're trying to get them to use Creative Commons licenses. So the question is, how do we build a scholarly communication policy in an African environment that addresses the whole ecosystem of communication from an African perspective in the current digital world? And that slight challenge, I throw to Michelle.